Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Fighting talk. Charlie Kirk was always up for a debate, and now the right-wing activist's shooting death on a Utah University campus is prompting renewed discussion about political speech in America and how frequently it descends into violence.
And different strokes. We'll hear from a British Olympian turned enhanced games participant who explains why he's excited to compete in an event where doping is allowed, even though critics call it dangerous and irresponsible.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. The Tally Gallery at Bemidji State University hosts a new exhibit of work by Marlee Call, looking back at Call's 60-year artistic journey with some never-before-seen works, on display through October 30th. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. I'm going to play a song for you. This is a new one from the band The Lone Below. This song is called Common.
Long story short, I met a hero yesterday. Yeah, he was cutting grass over someone else's grave. Newport in his left hand, firm shake on his right. Just takes a lifetime to get here, but it can happen overnight. He was looking over someone who was looking over him. There was thunder in the distance, a storm came rolling in.
He said, friend, I'm not above you. Sure as hell, I'm not below. I'm somewhere in the middle with all the common folk. I got friends in both places, some I love the most. I'm somewhere in the middle with all the
underneath cheap halogen lights, night shift nurse was drinking coffee after saving someone's life. He was screaming down the hallway, she was leaning on the wall. Heard her singing out a prayer, Lord, I surrender all. She was looking out for someone who was looking down on her. There was thunder in the distance, and she sang to him these words.
Friend, I'm not above you, sure as hell I'm not below. I'm somewhere in the middle with all the common folk. I got friends in both places, some I miss the most. I'm somewhere in the middle with all the common folk. Common folk. Common folk. Common folk. Common
story short, Dad had nothing left to hide. Spent his whole life serving something that kept him all locked up inside. They thanked him for his service when the army sent him back. He was fighting for his country. They were using him for scraps.
I asked him for the reason why they sent him off at all. Said, go be with your family. Good to see you standing tall.
All the common folk. I got
And that's The Lone Below with the song Common.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
For the sake of argument, a college student who debated Charlie Kirk on his campus tour says a lot of the popular right-wing activists' beliefs crossed a line, but his death is inarguably wrong.
The high is the limit. Detractors have said the privately financed enhanced games are a clown show, but a British swimmer says he's eager to see how far sanctioned doping can take athletes like him.
Drive safely as Prime Minister Mark Carney unveils the first of what he calls his nation-building projects. Mining industry leaders are hopeful the first initiatives will pave the way for all-weather road infrastructure in the north.
Dark web. Scientists are amazed at the remarkable diversity of dancing peacock spiders and turn to an analysis of what's known as dark DNA to help untangle things.
Losing his coup, a mechanic in Texas tells us about the moment his pet pigeon went missing and how local police helped him track down the beloved blind bird named Kevin.
And flushed with success. Rick Astley shares the story of hearing his 1987 hit Never Gonna Give You Up in a Tokyo toilet that, oddly, was entirely dedicated to him and his music. As it happens, the Thursday edition, Radio That Hopes, the song is a number one and number two hit. As we go to air, police are still searching for the person who killed prominent right-wing activist Charlie Kirk before a crowd of hundreds. Mr. Kirk was shot yesterday at Utah Valley University during one of his Prove Me Wrong debates, in which he challenged students to discuss hot-button issues. He was 31 years old. The conservative commentator and close ally of President Donald Trump was credited with attracting young voters to the Republican Party and the MAGA movement. His admirers commended him for his openness to debate controversial subjects. In those debates, he would voice his disdain for liberal views like gender identity, the civil rights movement, and gun control. Levi Kuvert participated in one of those Prove Me Wrong debates when Charlie Kirk visited his campus in April. He's the editor-in-chief of the Washington State University student paper, The Daily Evergreen. We reached him in Pullman, Washington.
Levi, you were at an event just like this one just a few months ago on your own campus. So when you found out about what happened in Utah, what went through your mind?
Yeah, my first thought was shock. And then my second thought was, like, this could have happened here. You know, he was on our campus in April, and, you know, I was just kind of putting myself in the shoes of the people who were there in Utah, because that could have been me, that it could have happened here. So very kind of just unsettling to think about.
Mm-hmm. You didn't just attend or watch from afar. You lined up for hours, and you wanted to debate Charlie Kirk in one of these Prove Me Wrong debates. Why did you want to do that?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I've seen the Prove Me Wrong clips all over YouTube and TikTok. And so I was familiar with what he was doing there. And I thought, here's my chance to go and talk to a guy that I really do not agree with on most things. But my chance to go kind of have a conversation with him and see if maybe I could either get him to agree with something I said or disagree. And so I was more, honestly, it was curiosity that drew me there, and it was also just this idea that, yeah, this guy is very influential, so I want to hear what he has to say.
And how did you feel about how your debate went?
So I asked him about the media and whether or not he thought it was okay for President Trump to be sort of picking and choosing which media outlets should get to cover him in the White House. I was kind of asking him, do you feel like that's consistent with the principles of free speech that he stood for, because he was very, you know, a big free speech advocate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he disagreed. He didn't think that it was, he thought that the president should be able to do that and should be able to have that power. It was mostly respectful. I do think that he kind of has a bit of a, I'm smarter than you sort of attitude. But at the end of the day, he didn't make me feel any sort of like, he didn't make me feel attacked or anything.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece for your paper You said it's called I Debated Charlie Kirk. He did not deserve to die. You describe that, you know, you write, yes, he was a bit of a jerk. Yes, he held extreme political beliefs. That does not justify violence, unquote. I imagine you wrote this in the middle of the night, as you know, after everything was unfolding. What propelled you to do that?
I just felt kind of called to. I think I saw a lot of reactions, a lot of very different reactions. Some people were, you know, in tears over this, but other people were almost, it felt like, happy about it. And I just felt like something had to be said. And so, yeah, I just wanted to write about kind of my experience and why, yeah, I'm not a fan of Charlie Kirk, but at the same time, I don't think anyone should be dead for their opinions.
And he was very open about his opinions, clearly, and they were controversial in some cases very, very hateful on issues such as race, sexuality, gender, gun control, and those are just a few. Being on a campus in the U.S., what was the thing that made so many of his fans and followers, what was he saying that resonated with them?
From what I could tell, and from people that I knew who were fans of him, what he did really well to inspire young people was he talked about giving their life a purpose. And I think for a lot of people who are kind of searching for a purpose, and they found it in conservative politics, and they found it in kind of his brand of conservative politics, which is a very community-based brand. And I think that's what people resonated with, was like, This is a group of people who are all kind of believing the same things, and they viewed him as kind of like a leader and kind of a voice for their generation, I think. Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump, the U.S. president, has blamed Democrats and the left for fueling political violence. Others on the other side have said that the Trump administration and folks like Charlie Kirk are inflaming the situation and the divisions. What do you think?
I think everyone is inflaming it, and I don't think that... I think it really did kind of start... around the time that President Trump kind of started rising to prominence. And when I was a kid, you know, it didn't feel like this. It didn't feel like everyone was always kind of attacking each other and spewing all this political vitriol and political violence happening everywhere. And it really does feel like that this has kind of sprung up over the past, you know, 8-9 years. So I do think there's some correlation there with the president and some of his rhetoric. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that these debates, even though people connected with them, or that Kirk himself was inflaming tensions as well?
I think there were some. The debates were interesting because on the one hand, he was definitely promoting free speech in a way that I think was probably healthy to do that, you know, to have students talking and to get students talking. But I do think that maybe he would have been wiser to stay away from some controversial issues. He would get people riled up. He got me riled up. I was pretty annoyed when I left the debate with him. Not from what I had debated with him, but from what the person after me actually. And I was very mad after. So yeah, I do think that he kind of got. Yeah, I agree.
What was that debate? The one after you?
Yeah, the one after me was a debate about transgender rights, and he said some things that I really do not agree with, and it definitely, I think, rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, because, you know, Washington State, we're fairly open in Washington State, and he seemed very close-minded. Certain topics like that, he definitely could have maybe not instigated so much hate when he spoke. Yeah.
You're at one of the most important and wonderful times, usually, of a young person's life as a college or university student. You're finding yourself, you're finding your friends, you're building your future, really, by what you're doing there on campus. So how does all of this make you feel about your future and the future of your country?
Yeah, it definitely doesn't feel great seeing, you know, obviously one of the leading activists getting killed. And just a couple months ago, there was Congress people getting shot at from Minnesota, I believe. So it definitely is scary. And it makes, you know, my friends and I were having a conversation just yesterday about what would we do if things got even worse? You know, what would our escape plan almost be? Like, how would we kind of get out of it? And I it's a bummer that has to happen, because you're right. I feel like I should be more excited about the future of the country, but I'm definitely feeling like something's got to change here, or else we're headed in the wrong direction, I think, as a nation.
Levi, I appreciate this. Please take care, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Levi Kuvert is the editor-in-chief of the Washington State University student paper, The Daily Evergreen. We reached him in Pullman, Washington. Whether it's Michael Phelps in the pool, Usain Bolt on the track, or Simone Biles on the vault, when you watch a gifted athlete in peak form, it's transcendent. More so because what they do seems superhuman. But what if you yourself could become superhuman simply through a lot of focused training and also a lot of banned substances? This is the question asked by the Enhanced Games. The privately funded event planned for next year allows athletes to take FDA-approved performance-enhancing drugs and has offered a prize of $1 million to people who break certain world records. And the games are already afoot. In February, a quote-unquote enhanced swimmer from Greece sort of broke a long-standing world record in the 50-meter freestyle. Ben Proud is an Olympic swimmer, and yesterday he became the first British athlete to sign up. We reached him in Dubai.
Ben, you're 30, which is young. I think maybe athletes feel differently, but you're young. You won the silver medal in Paris at the Olympics. You were looking ahead, as far as everyone was thinking. You know, you're looking ahead to Los Angeles in 2028. So why do this now? Why sign up for this and say goodbye to your career as it was?
You know, I might bring you back to when I first kind of heard about it, you know, back in May when they announced it, and Christian, the current athlete, had broken the world record. And for me in my life, you know, I've always pursued to be the fastest man in the water. Racing the 50 freestyle is very much, you want to be the best, you want to be the fastest. It's all to do with speed. And so suddenly when he broke this in the enhanced format, it suddenly diverged everything I knew about my event and my domain into these two categories. You know, one was traditional and one was this new enhanced route. And so to go for the title of the fastest man in the world, you know, if you do that in the traditional route, suddenly you might not be the fastest man in water. I'm really satisfied with my career. I think I've had a fantastic time. I think I've realistically achieved everything I could have wanted to. And you know, I'm kind of searching for something new, some new motivations, like something that will kind of push me on these next few years.
There are risks, potentially, concerns and questions, public criticism as well. We'll get to all of that. But also, as our listeners heard, there's a $1 million prize associated with this. How much did that money factor in to your decision?
Yeah, it definitely affected it. And to be honest, that first day when I found out and, you know, I saw one of my old training partners break the world record and get handed this $1 million deal or prize money, it did kind of fill me with a bit of envy, because you don't see that sort of money in swimming. You know, if we take out the world records and look at the wins, they're offering $250,000. And in the traditional sense, it would take about 13 years of winning world championships just to get that sort of money. Maybe somewhat selfishly, I kind of felt like I should deserve to give it a go and see what I can do.
In terms of the criticism, I wonder, you know, you mentioned your former training partner has done this, but other Olympians, what have they said to you? What are they telling you directly since hearing about your decision?
It's very polarizing. But to be honest, you know, I've been met with a lot of positive reactions from people that I've raced against, from friends, from family. Yeah, it's quite a mixed bag. But, you know, for me, I see this as very much the end of one era and start of another.
Aquatics Great Britain, as you know, but I'll let our listeners know, released a statement after your announcement saying, quote, that they stand firmly behind the values and principles of clean sport, unquote, and that they condemn your decision in the strongest terms, unquote. How do you respond to those kinds of concerns?
Well, with the statement, you know, I fully expected it. And to be honest, I really respect it, because they have their corner protect. You know, they have clean sport to really protect and ensure that it stays as clean as possible for the time to come. I know it brings a lot of controversy, but I'm trying to do it with as much respect to the sport that I've been a part of for so long, and not, you know, casting sort of like doubt or shame on this move. That's why I made my retirement yesterday, to make it very clear that, you know, I'm not trying to do both. This is me retiring from traditional swimming and moving on to something brand new.
You've said also in the past that anti-doping agencies aren't able to make sure everyone is clean at the Olympics or at other championships. Were you clean when you competed in the Olympics?
Yeah. I've held myself to the highest standards for as long as I can be competitive. And, you know, I'm a sucker for rules and I comply with it to the best of my ability. But, you know, it's just the fact that it's always going to be a cat and mouse game when it comes to the anti-doping world. You know, people create new things, new methods to get away with it. And it's just always a catch-up game for world anti-doping. And so, yeah, it brings in some fresh frustration because, you know, throughout the 12 years been around, there have been moments where people get by without, you know, justice being served. Like there are some cheaters who have done what they've done and not been served with a ban or somehow get away with it. And it's incredibly frustrating. Yeah, so I fully believe in clean sports, even though I am moving on to something which is, yeah, quite controversial.
The World Anti-Doping Agency has also weighed in, calling these enhanced games, quote, dangerous and irresponsible, unquote. You may have also seen the head of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency has called it a, quote, clown show. Do you worry not just about your own personal safety in terms of what you might be using to prepare for these games, but also that you might be being used?
Yeah, I understand your question. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, I could probably say that I'm also using them in the same way. Like, you know, because of the monetary value, mm-hmm. I am getting what I think is a fair deal out of this. And then when it comes to the, you know, the health concerns that, you know, is typically at the top of the list is, you know, I'm not obligated to take anything throughout this process. Mm-hmm. You know, if I were to choose to, I can remain clean and continue as I always have done to compete in the games. But because of this World Aquatics ban that you have if you endorse the enhanced games, I'm kind of forced to retire from the sport. And so I feel like I'm in a comfortable position, and any decision I do make in the future will be very much informed and with my health at the top of the list.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad we could speak, Ben. Thank you for this.
No problem. Thank you so much.
Ben Proud is an Olympic swimmer and the first British athlete to sign up for next year's enhanced games. We reached him in Dubai. It was the moment Luis Valdez had feared. Kevin was gone. Mr. Valdez is the owner of L&R Auto Service in Irving, Texas, and he told himself Kevin knew his way around the property, so he'd probably be right back, but he waited and waited, and Kevin did not appear. So he began a search that got more frantic as it went on. Kevin was nowhere to be found. Where could he have disappeared to? Well, that was the problem. He could be anywhere, and you couldn't just text him, because Kevin is a blind pigeon, and he doesn't even have a phone. But now he's back in Luis Valdez's care. We reached Mr. Valdez in Irving, Texas.
Luis, Kevin has certainly been on an adventure, to say the least. How's he doing today?
He's doing good. He's in his cage. I took him out already for a bit, and he's played with the other pigeons. He's been having a nice day, yes.
Are they glad to have him back?
Yes, they are.
If we go back to that day, you're in your shop. Mm-hmm. Kevin goes missing. How did it all happen?
It was so quick. Usually when I do an inspection, I take him out of his cage. So he's always around me. That day, it was Saturday morning, and it usually gets really busy. And once I noticed, he landed on the trunk of the car, of the truck. And
this was the truck that you were working on or inspecting,
yes,
in your shop?
I was inspecting. Mm-hmm. And It just, once I realized the truck had already took off and I had no information of the customer. The only thing I had was his license plate and VIN number. And I had so many other customers waiting for me. So I tried to call the insurance because I think he had State Farm. They were
Right away, or did you have to look at the other customers first, or did you tell them to wait?
No, I was multitasking. I was doing both. Yes, and I called, but they were. It was no help. It was Saturday. They were not answering, and there was two officers, two police cars, in the parking lot, and I was hesitating. I was really. It took me around 5 minutes to go and ask. I thought they were not going to believe me, or they were, you know, they probably had some other stuff to do. So
you'd imagine.
I crossed the street and I went up to them and I told them, I need help. This is my story. It's going to sound a little weird, but, and I told them, if you could give me the person, I have his license plate. If you can give me his phone number or address, I don't want him to be afraid when you guys show up.
Right.
They were not able to give me that information. They told me they were going to have to go on their own.
They're going to do it themselves. So you tell the story. I'm imagining their faces as you tell them the story. How were they reacting?
Yes, at first. And he said, what? Can you rephrase that? A blind pigeon. They both, their faces were a blind pigeon. And one of the officers said, give me the license plate.
Okay.
And that's when they were like, okay, we're going to go look. You stay, you know, you go do your thing and we're going to go.
Incredible. And so, yeah, obviously they couldn't give you the personal details of the person, but they did offer to go. There is actually video and audio from the police body cam of the very moment the officers crack this case. Let's listen to that.
Yes.
Hi, how are you, sir?
I'm good.
I'm about to tell you the weirdest thing you've probably ever heard in your life, okay? So did you just get your truck inspected?
Yeah.
Okay, so that guy has a pet pigeon, and it's in the back of your truck.
I just imagine the gentleman's face is blurred in the video, but, you know, police show up on your doorstep. A lot of things could happen. That's probably not one that anyone would expect.
Yes, I imagine. He was wondering what was going on.
And how long between the time Kevin disappeared and to when you got him back?
I think it was no more than 40 minutes. It was probably 30, 40 minutes.
That's pretty incredible. What did you say to the officers when they came back?
I was so thankful, so nervous. I really didn't know how to thank them because I know it took them their time. I told them if they ever need anything, you know, inspection or anything, to come by. But I was very thankful.
And you describe in that video that he's like a child to you. You have other pigeons as well. But your relationship with Kevin, how did you first meet?
It was 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I take care of the pigeons that come to the shop. I feed them. I try to help them in the back of the shop. I put boxes so they can build their nest. And I saw that Kevin, they would throw him out of the nest. I took him in. He was around 2 weeks old. I started feeding him. I didn't know he was blind. Later, a month later, I noticed that he would try to fly, but not properly. And he would just spin around. And it's been like that ever since. So it's a different relationship I have with him. Daily, I have to check on him.
What does your family think about this, or your customers? Do they get along with Kevin?
Oh, yes, especially this Argentine customer that he comes and he takes him out and starts telling, hey, Kevin, ¿qué pasa, Kevin? And Kevin listens. Yes, and my mother always, every time I take him home, she's, where's Kevin and how's Kevin? Oh. And my one-year-old, he likes to play with Kevin and just... And then 2 years taking care of Kevin is just for him to, you know, just do it. He wouldn't survive in the streets or anything. He wouldn't make it. So all that crossed my mind. But when I saw the cops pull to the shop and then I saw him getting down and opening the rear door, I was, I was seriously,
it's emotional, right?
Yes. I didn't know this was going to happen.
Luis, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you for sharing this time with me.
Luis Valdez is the caretaker of a blind pigeon named Kevin. We reached him at his auto repair shop in Irving, Texas. I guess it was a square Pegasus in a round hole. Recently, in what's being called the greatest discovery of all time, paleontologists unearthed the fossil of what appears to be a horse with enormous wings. And what's more, they've managed to ascertain exactly what its mating call would have sounded like. And it's absolutely unforgettable. In a world exclusive, we'll play that haunting call for you right now. We really got you that time. We Rickrolled you. Never gets old. Although, to be fair, some people do believe it got old about 16 years ago. And I'm one of those people. And so are you. But you know who isn't one of those people? Rick Astley. He's been belting out Never Gonna Give You Up since it came out in 1987, and he claims not to be sick of it. His lush pompadour may have shrunk over the years, but his appreciation for his biggest hit never has. He enjoyed it during the Rick Rolling era. He lent it out to commercials.
Desert you. Rick Astley? Are you rolling me?
Not this time. This year, you don't have to give up everything you love. Snack a little smarter with Frito-Lay.
And he was slightly confused, but not displeased, when he heard it on a toilet in Japan. Recently, Mr. Astley was a guest on a BBC Manchester call-in show when he answered this question from a fan.
Where is the most bizarre place that you've heard Never Gonna Give You Up being played?
That's a good one.
That's an easy one, that. Are you ready for this? So, my wife is Danish, and we have some friends in Denmark who have a beer company, and they've got bars and what have you. When we were in Tokyo a few years back, we wanted to go to the bar that they have there. And when you go in the... there's no way to say this any better than this. Toilet. Mm-hmm. You go in the loo, and all it does is play Rick Astley songs. So I've sat in a Japanese toilet listening to myself while looking at pictures of myself... on the toilet wall.
Rick Astley, describing his experience in a Rick Astley-themed toilet on the BBC. Now, here's Rick Astley with Never Gonna Give You Up. Aretha Franklin with Don't Play That Song.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, a new documentary explores one of the most enduring sagas in Canadian entertainment. Two cast members talk about their time on Degrassi, a show that was sometimes as dramatic for its cast as for its characters.
And exposure therapy. An evolutionary biologist says nothing will help you overcome your fear of spiders quite like watching a whole bunch of them dance.
They like Aretha. I don't know.
Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
He can be so mean. He told me, darling, darling, I love you. Baby, baby, you lied. Darling, I love you.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River / Dead Set with Steve Ross. They'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids. The Martini Monday music series continues with PK Mayo and Greg Kaiser on September 22nd from 5 to 8 p.m., presenting a variety of original songs and familiar compositions. Information about upcoming events is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Nyahwea Bemidji area, in partnership with the Bemidji Trap and Skeet Club, will hold a trap tournament Thursday, September 25th. The registration deadline is September 22nd. Find more details at United Way Bemidji. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens here on KAXE KBXE.
He built anticipation, and now Prime Minister Mark Carney has revealed what else his government wants to build. Today in Edmonton, he unveiled the first five so-called nation-building projects, including expanding liquefied natural gas production in BC and creating Canada's first small modular reactor in Darlington, Ontario. The Prime Minister said his government will move those projects swiftly through any remaining approvals. And he also made promises about the development of a slew of other projects that could be part of a next wave, including an Arctic Economic and Security Corridor, a new port at Grays Bay, Nunavut, and all-weather road infrastructure in northern Canada. Here's Mr. Carney speaking to reporters earlier today.
The Arctic Corridor will open up promising advanced stage mineral projects through critical links from port to port to port. And with increasingly open Arctic waters, rapid advances in cyber, artificial intelligence, and quantum, paired with advanced missile capacities of our adversaries, we can no longer rely on our geography to protect us.
Kenny Ruptash is the president of the Northwest Territories and Nunavut Chamber of Mines. We reached him in Yellowknife.
Kenny, how long have you been waiting to hear words like that from the Prime Minister?
The NWT Nunavut Chamber of Mines has been working on this project for, well, over a decade in multiple iterations, and it's encouraging to hear, but it'll be more encouraging to see some yellow iron start pushing a road.
Yeah, Ottawa has, as you well know, funded planning studies for this sort of thing in the past, did not formally commit to the project then, and still has not. And we should say this was on the secondary list of what was released today, not the first bit of the list that the Prime Minister was talking about. So what is different this time? Does that placement on the list concern you?
No, not at all. First, I would break the road into two segments. We've got a segment on the Nunavut side and a segment on the Northwest Territories side. Mm-hmm. So to the Nunavut side, the initiative is actually being led by an Inuit-owned company, and specifically the Kitikmeot Inuit Association, who has an equity stake in the company who's advancing the planning of the road. So on the Yellowknife side, or the NWT side, we've got two Indigenous governments kind of leading the charge here and working with the federal government, the territorial government, and industry to kind of optimize the alignment of the road. So I would say what's different this time is we've got Inuit and Indigenous engagement, and not just engagement as in consultation, but engagement as in participation and what I believe to be positioning for equity participation.
And to be clear for our listeners, what you're pushing for is called the Slave Geological Province Corridor. How close is what you heard from the Prime Minister talking about to what you've been pushing for?
So I think these are all one corridor. We've been calling it the Slave Geological Province Corridor. That is on the south side, the NWT side. Mm-hmm. The north side has been called the Grays Bay Port and Road, and I believe the language he used was a security and economic corridor.
Yeah, we heard the allusions there pretty clear about defense, right? Protecting Canadian territory. What do you make of that argument that others have made as well, that this is about defense as much as access for people and mining, which you're concerned with as well?
Well, I would argue that a large part of the Arctic is only monitored by a handful of communities and mining projects that are operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. A large portion of the Arctic is unmonitored to some degree. So the infrastructure, I think the important piece here from the resource perspective is the mineral endowments of the two territories are tremendous. And Arctic Economic and Security Corridor really opens access to some of Canada's richest deposits in critical minerals. So why we find that important is these minerals are essential for energy security and national defense systems. So this isn't just a national defense, let's see who's in our backyard, but it can also be an economic driver, which feeds the energy and security systems as well.
There certainly has been a lot of discussion about getting these projects off the ground and doing it quickly. There are those who are worried that it might be all happening a little bit too quickly. What would you say to them?
So I would say, unlike Southern Canada, where there's overlapping federal and provincial reviews and Indigenous consultation and engagement isn't as incorporated as in the North. The NWT and Nunavut have co-management regimes established in the late 90s that already deliver single integrated regulatory reviews for major projects. The framework is kind of administered by a federal, territorial, and Indigenous government appointments. So we've got those three levels of government actually making the decisions. And I suppose another important consideration from a Indigenous perspective is the regime incorporates UNDRIP principles and have been doing so almost a decade before the UN adopted the declaration. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as Canada moves to kind of nationalize the one review concept, I think it could look north to a proven blueprint where mm-hmm. co-management already exists and has been a proven for nearly 30 years.
What are you hearing from people you work with, people who live there as well, as this news, you know, trickles out?
Well, we've been working with Indigenous governments and Inuit organizations on the development or strategic alignment of this road. The kind of guiding principles on the optimization of the route selection are kind of founded in three areas. One, you have to be able to construct it. You can't build over a swamp or over a lake. Two, let's connect some communities along the way. And three, proximity to mineral endowment and specifically critical minerals. So we've been engaged on this for a long time, and yeah. It's not something that just kind of popped up to us.
That connecting of communities is so key. I mean, we do different kinds of stories every year, every winter, about the issues when those kind of connections don't exist. If this, in fact, happens this time and goes ahead, you know, what do you envision for the future for these communities?
I can say that it would fundamentally change the cost of living and the access to the Western Arctic. Right now, a large portion of the delivery service or shipping service goes around from Montreal or ports in and around Montreal. And if we can designate a port in the north in the Arctic where we can have a jump off to the communities, it'll change the way communities operate and resupply.
Kenny, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your time.
Kenny Robtash is the president of the Northwest Territories and Nunavut Chamber of Mines. He's in Yellowknife. There were 96 children at a Richmond Hill, Ontario daycare yesterday afternoon when a car plowed through its window, and now one of them is dead. Today, police charged a driver with one count of dangerous operation causing death and two counts of dangerous operation causing bodily harm. Police have said they don't believe the crash was intentional, but they haven't announced how it happened in the midst of afternoon pickup time. The community is mourning the death of a 1.5-year-old boy and trying to support others who were affected, including three staff members and six other children who were injured, one of whom is in critical condition. David West is the mayor of Richmond Hill. He talked to CBC Toronto about the crash and its effect on the families and the wider community.
The thing that we're dealing with most right now is the whole incident and the injury of so many little kids, but also in particular the death of one of them. It's just been a horrible day in Richmond Hill. I am quite certain that this is the worst day that I've ever had as an elected official in our great city. I mean, I'm a parent, I am a citizen of this city, and to imagine the situation that these people are in is just unthinkable, even today after this has had some time to sink in.
Do you know what it was like for the other parents who came to pick up their kids having heard about this?
Well, I'm sure it was just absolute chaos. To hear that this was happening and in the moments after, not all of the information was available. I mean, it must have been absolutely horrible. And the parents that I've spoken to up to this point, I mean, they were clearly very, very shaken, and I can certainly understand why.
This building is on a corner. Is it possible a driver lost control after making a turn?
No, this was not it. The parking lot is at the back of the building. And from what I understand, the vehicle's penetration into the building was from the parking lot, not from Yonge Street. So that was not the case.
It was an elderly driver, in this case, driver in their 70s. Is there consideration that there was maybe a mix-up between drive and reverse or gas and brake?
I think that's kind of one of the main items that the police are looking at right now, I would have to assume. As far as I understand, the car was in the parking lot before this happened. So obviously something went terribly wrong. It'll be up to York Regional Police to do the investigation to determine what exactly happened and why. You know, we are a strong community, and we will stand together and do what we need to do to help everybody get through this.
David West is the mayor of Richmond Hill, Ontario. He was talking to David Common, host of Metro Morning. It sounds like the distant rumble of a thunderstorm, but it's something more powerful and more erotic. It's actually the sick moves of a male peacock spider dancing ferociously to attract a mate. The tiny Australian spiders are fascinating to watch, in part because since they have 8 legs, they could wipe the floor with any human at Dance Dance Revolution, and in part because if you look closely, you'll see that peacock spiders are very diverse in appearance and behavior. And now researchers are wondering whether what's known as dark DNA is behind the spider's extreme variation. Jonah Walker is an evolutionary biologist at the Sanger Institute, and we reached him in Cambridge, UK.
Jonah, how does someone go from being a little bit afraid of spiders, as I heard you used to be, to studying them and watching them dance?
Yeah, well, I think like a lot of people, growing up, I was a little bit apprehensive about spiders. I never wanted to be the one getting them out of the room. But really, you only have to spend a few moments watching or experiencing in the flesh the dancing of the peacock spiders to get over that, and for any sort of fear to just sort of be brushed away. And that's an experience that's not just my own, but so many people that I speak to, people that I meet on the street who sort of have learned about peacock spiders and who, yeah, use them almost as a sort of gateway spider to start spider. Enjoying and appreciating other spiders.
So I was going to say, are you still concerned about other types of spiders and only like the peacock, or this has broadened your love of all of them?
No, it has been a sort of form of protracted exposure therapy, and I am much more comfortable now with a lot of other spiders.
Understood. And it is quite something. I just watched a short video online of a couple of peacock spiders dancing. It was fantastic. They have some great moves. And then their name, peacock spiders, gives us a bit of a hint. But describe for our listeners what they look like.
Yeah, so peacock spiders are a group of tiny spider species that are found only in Australia. And as their name suggests, they're a little bit like peacock birds. So the females are brown, while the males are brightly coloured. And the males perform elaborate brightly coloured courtship dances to try to attract the attention of females and try to convince those females to mate with them. And one of the most extraordinary things about these peacock spiders is just how diverse they are. So there are a little over 100 odd species that are currently known. We're discovering a few more each year. And each one of those species has a completely different dance. Essentially, the male will raise its abdomen, so its backside, into the air. Some species will then sort of unfold it almost like origami to reveal a brightly colored pattern that it waves around in the air. And most of the males will lift one, sometimes two, or even four of their legs up in the air and wave them around too.
And when you said they were tiny, how small are we talking?
really small, so you could fit four of them onto your smallest fingernail.
Oh my goodness. You talked about their diversity, and you are researching why they are so diverse, and dark DNA is at the heart of this. A couple questions there. I think most people may not have heard of that phrase. What is dark DNA?
So the DNA, the genetic material of organisms, is arranged into the genome. That's all of the DNA in an organism. And that genome comprises genes, which I think most people have heard of. They're the kind of things that might control traits like in humans, eye color or height. Mm-hmm. But the genome contains a lot more DNA outside the genes. So between all of the genes, you have a lot of DNA that for a long time we didn't really know what it did. And we called it junk DNA, thinking it was kind of just there.
Just extra.
But increasingly, we're finding that that DNA that we now call repetitive DNA or perhaps dark DNA is actually really important, and it can have profound influences on an organism's life. And what makes the peacock spiders interesting in this regard is the fact that they have a lot of this dark DNA, of this repetitive DNA, in between the genes. So to put it into perspective, humans have a genome that's about three times smaller than the peacock spider genome, despite the fact, as I said, that peacock spiders are absolutely tiny. They have so much more DNA in each cell than a human does. And so we think that this expansion of the genetic material in peacock spiders might have something to do with why their behaviors and their appearances are as diverse as they are.
And why they have such great rhythm.
Exactly.
An understanding of romantic pursuits. But how did you go about recording their dances?
So, well, the first thing you have to do is actually just find these spiders, which I'm sure you can appreciate is no mean feat. Just say how small they are, and they're found all across Australia. So it really is like trying to find needles in a haystack. One of the things that we're interested in is not just the movements that they make and the colours that the males use in their dances, but also the vibrations that they produce. So each peacock spider species has a different song. And to go about recording these songs, these vibrations, we have a slightly makeshift setup. Essentially, what we do is we get a pair of nylon tights, we stretch it very, very tight across an embroidery hoop, and then we put a male and a female peacock spider onto it. We wait for the male to get dancing, and then we can use a machine called a laser vibrometer, which is just a fancy term for a machine that points a laser down at the nylon tight surface, then bounces it back up. And so we can listen to the vibrations that the males are producing.
That's a pretty ingenious setup, the embroidery hoop and the tights.
It took a little bit of finessing by some wonderful collaborators of ours at Berkeley in the US. But yeah, we've figured it. You do get some strange looks when you're preparing for field work and you're marching around haberdasheries to get lots of embroidery hoops and then going into a department store to get an awful lot of tights.
So if, in fact, in the end, dark DNA, that forgotten DNA, proves to be the key here, what might that mean more broadly?
Well, it's important to recognize that this dark DNA, this repetitive DNA, isn't only found in peacock spiders. They have a lot of it, but we find it in just about every organism out there. And so by understanding how this repetitive dark DNA operates in peacock spiders, we hope that we can understand the general principles about how it might be working in other animals, plants, fungi, including ourselves. So it should hopefully give us a real understanding of how the genome and DNA functions all across the tree of life. And we hope also help to explain why other groups of organisms, like the peacock spiders, might be really diverse or not diverse.
Jonah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much.
Jonah Walker is an evolutionary biologist at the Sanger Institute. He's in Cambridge, UK. Just like at the high school in the show, things were not always sunny on the set of Degrassi. A new documentary examining the child actors' experience, the good and the bad, is premiering at the Toronto International Film Festival on Saturday. Amanda Steptoe and Miriam McDonald, better known as Degrassi mother and daughter Spike and Emma, talked about appearing in that documentary.
It was definitely not a decision that I made lightly. There were absolute highs and there were challenging moments. And in my private life now, I've departed from the industry, so I've spent the last few years creating a very private world for myself. So stepping back in front of the camera felt foreign, and it felt like a bit of a challenge for me, I would say. But I really felt strongly that there was more of a story to be told about what their true experience was. In my past, I felt an obligation to make everything just kind of come off as if it was perfect, which wasn't true. And it's also not what the audience ever wanted. They wanted authentic, honest, relatable stories. So I came into the interview process thinking, this is what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna be as vulnerable as they need me to be to share something real and meaningful.
Similar to Miriam, where we're like, I don't know if I wanna put on that facade and be, everything was great. My life is so perfect because of the show. And, you know, especially after the show got so, so huge and then it ending and, you know, not having enough money for groceries yet still being in the public eye. And it really kind of makes an impact on you. So it would be opening up that.
What you said about the facade, I feel like in the past, I would put on a facade for an interview. This documentary gave me the chance to take the facade off. In my experience, a part of it was a fame seminar that the show actually put us through. And we were always trained to put the positive spin onto everything. And I was a people pleaser, and I wanted to please my agent and my mother and the, you know, everybody on the team. So it really always felt sort of like this obligation that despite what was going on beneath the surface, suppress it, keep it inside, don't necessarily share it. And this kind of liberated me to be able to be honest in a way that I'd never given myself permission to be in the past. I also felt there was a misconception about this glow up that people referred to me having, when in reality I was recovering from anorexia. And my glow up was actually just kind of finding my healthy body. So as much as I sort of found it flattering that people would say, oh, I had this glow up in season whatever, inside it was this bittersweet feeling because it was like a painful glow up in a way. People would come up to me and cry, and they would be pouring their hearts out to me as if we were best friends. And it's such an honor to have been able to kind of elicit that degree of relatability with somebody. I mean, I definitely felt grateful to be given this opportunity to be like a vessel in a way for that. And I definitely find that in my own experience, seeing someone going through something similar, it provides a light for you. It's just somehow something inspiring, something that makes you feel less alone. Like, you just feel like you have a teammate when you see someone going through something that you're going through.
Miriam McDonald and Amanda Steptoe, who played Emma and Spike, talking to CBC reporter Hayden Waters about the documentary Degrassi, Whatever It Takes.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
And you are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 in Brainerd. And you can hear us on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org. My name's Steve Ross. I'm your volunteer host tonight. I'll be here till 10 o'clock. Got an hour of On the River. It's a mix of music from everything from jazz, country, rock, a little bit of everything mixed in there. And then coming up at 8 o'clock is The Dead Set, music of the Grateful Dead and their related bands. We've got a great show in that coming your way with some Bobby and Rob Wasserman and some Jerry Garcia, of course, and some other artists doing